football on off the ball.
But yeah, there's some good managers floating around, and that's in a way what the Premier League's become. It is a home of star coaches as much as, well, more than star players.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.
All right, you're welcome along to the Sunday Paper Review on this, the 17th of May, 2026. Coming at you if you're watching us, listen to us live at the earlier time this Sunday of 10:30. Delighted to say we're joined in studio by the sports writer, Kieran Cunningham. Kieran, good morning to you.
Morning.
Thanks for coming in. And former Ireland international, now coach, pundit, etc., etc. Fiona Hayes, how are you?
Good, Adrian. Not too bad.
Very good. Lots of excitement in the air today. We'll get to that in just a moment, but we'll let you know, first of all, what's happening across the sports pages to begin with. And we're going to start with the Sunday Times that's got Mr. Motivator is the headline here on the front page of the Sunday Times. And a pretty delighted Callum McGregor alongside his manager Martin O'Neill in the aftermath of, I don't think drama quite puts the finger on it, if I've been totally honest, but events at Celtic Park yesterday. Martin O'Neill inspires Celtic Scottish Premiership title after dramatic final day wins is the headline. And then alongside it by Mark Palmer, shameful Celtic fans slammed by Hearts. So they rushed the pitch after the third goal went in, and I don't think the final whistle actually ever went in the end, but the match was over, and it seems like some Hearts players were set upon physically and verbally as well. So I'm sure there'll be much more on that and on. Alonso set for 4-year contract to take charge of Chelsea, writes Peter Rutzler. Well, events in the last few minutes have transpired, and he has been given a 4-year contract, Xabi Alonso. Not trusted, Kieran, as much as Liam Senior with the 6.5 years, but nevertheless, the inevitable has happened. And
yeah, but I just checked every 4 weeks came in, and the last 4 years, if you count the interim and managers, they've had 8 managers. So it wouldn't be putting the mortgage on seeing that the 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah, but even with that as well, it's like having that manager title, like with coach, you know, the way they do that, you can't pick your signings, whereas if he's manager, at least we know he can control who he's bringing out. Not that Chelsea need any more players, to be honest.
Well, I think Chelsea were doing Lemar Senior a favour, if you want to look at it that way, and maybe the dynamic shifts with Xabi Alonso when he gets to call the shots a little bit more.
A little bit more, you'd hope, anyway, if you're a Chelsea fan.
He's a funny one because it's such hot property, and he's effectively, it's based on one season. Yeah. You know, and it was an immense achievement to win the Bundesliga with Bayer Leverkusen. But other than that, you know, the following season didn't do well, didn't make any impact in the Champions League. Yeah. Real Madrid, he's gone after a few months, and I know Real Madrid is a very difficult club for any manager, and there's different factions in the dressing room that run the place. But he has a lot to prove, and by all accounts, he's quite doctrinaire. You know, he has very firm in what he wants, and he wants things done his way. And a lot of the Real players were in revolt over that. And see how that works out at Chelsea, because you see this around the Mohamed Salah. I'm sure we'd mention it, but his Instagram post basically he put the boot into Arne Slot, and he referenced the Jurgen Klopp in the language he used in "We went from doubters to believers in heavy metal football," which were Klopp quotes. So he's effectively saying, Arne Slot, you're no Jurgen Klopp. But he's similar to Alonso Slot in that he has a very defined way of playing. And he's determined no matter what. And like this season is a season where they've lost nearly 20 games, but he's stuck to that.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting how the Chelsea players respond to Alonso. They don't have Champions League, and you know, they'll probably, remains to be seen, you know, what their schedule will be like next season. But there is talent there.
I thought it was interesting because I thought it was a kite to begin with. I just thought, they'll fly this, but he's no intention of going to Chelsea. And it's just to like snuff Liverpool out ultimately, because that's where he's going to end up going. But it's not to say that he can't ever go to Liverpool now, but it definitely pushes it down the road.
Well, it pushes down the road. Because Liverpool fans are incredibly sentimental about their past. Like, they're not unusual.
You've won beside
same here. but they cling, you know, so they just assume because somebody was a Liverpool legend, they want to manage Liverpool. But I think, you know, he might well, you know, the Liverpool job isn't up for grabs at the moment anyway, but if it was, you might well look at the squads and think Chelsea have more about them. But it's funny, I had an encounter, and I just checked his Wikipedia page, Alonso, and is still on his bloody Wikipedia page that he's a Meath Gaelic football fan. Like, this has followed him around. And the origin of that story was back in when I was working for the Star in 2005. I was going to cover the Champions League final in Istanbul. And Gordon Manning, who's now with the Irish Times, he's from Meath, and he had, through his Meath connections, he'd heard that Alonso had lived in Kells as a teenager learning English. And he managed to track down the family, and he got photographs of the 15-year-old Alonso with the family. So we thought this would be a good feature, but it would be better if we got Alonso to talk about it. So I was sent over to the press day, which was a week before the Champions League final, the press day at Anfield. And only one player was being put up, so it was a long shot. And Alonso was put up. But it was like Liverpool in the Champions League final. You have what they call the number ones over there, the football writers. You have the number one writers, number two, number three. And the number ones tend to have massive egos and profiles. And some of them were like were in a quarter of a million a year back then. They were massive money as well. Mm. And you think, how do you, like, they're asking all these very relevant questions about Milan and Liverpool. How do you bring up Kells at night when you're 15? But I thought I have to ask. So I asked him, is it true that you were learning this? So he gave a couple of lines on that. And then there had been this rumour that he'd played Gaelic football, which has since grown legs. So I asked him about that, and he said, no, he had a kick around on the green, like you used to kick around with the local
Trevor Giles and
Darren Fain. Well, he produced so many great
Boylan,
fullbacks.
Boylan was the reason my career took off.
He did say that he'd had a kick around sort of with local lads, and they would play the game, catch and kick and do a bit of soloing. But, by this stage, the other fellas were calling for security to get me out of there, I think. But it's amazing how things grow legs, because this went around for years then, that he played in Croke Park and won an underage title. And I was at a press club in Spain at the Euros in 2012 in Poland. He was asked about it, about playing Gaelic football in Meath. He was asked about it before a Bayer Leverkusen played the Europa League final in Dublin. He was asked about it in an Adidas gig in Germany when it was a Bayern Munich that some Irish journalist was sent over to. And I think he was asked another time. And he must think, who are these weird pixie heads, as Barry Murphy used to call them, that keep asking me for 3 weeks when I was 15.
You can rest assured that ain't the last time he's going to be asked about it either, particularly now that he's in the Premier League.
But we started it, or Gordon Manning started, because he was the one that came up with the photos and heard. It's all his fault.
Brilliant.
Although I'm sure he's supporting Westmeath today, Kieran, no doubt about it. He's got the arms cut off his jersey and he's ready to go. Right, elsewhere in the papers, Sunday Independent, Dublin smash and grab, dramatic finale as Galway concede 1-1 in the dying seconds, and delighted Brian Hayes there afterwards. He got the winning goal against Galway at Pearse Stadium. And then underneath that, Celtic beat Hearts to title in chaotic finale, late drama at Parkhead overshadowed by pitch invasion. The Mail on Sunday, Boy Wonder, O'Neill steals unlikeliest of titles as Celtic break Hearts amid the Parkhead chaos. It's the Mail on the Mirror. It's Boy Wonder's O'Neill, you've given me a reason to live. And then Silva's cheers with no beers. Chelsea nil, Man City won, the no beers bit being obviously there's still business to be done. From a City point of view, Semenyo, says the Sunday People, striker's stellar goal seals second trophy for City, but Pep insists on a booze ban. That's there. And then finally on the Sun, it's Time of My Life. Marit in Paradise as Kels lift title after their 3-1 win over Hearts yesterday, and Pep minds a treble. Oh my God is the other one over here. Oh my God, Jack Moylan in shock after realising a childhood dream to play for Ireland and score a hat-trick in the process. Ireland 5, Granada 0. I was really disappointed, and listen, it's more of a reflection on me. It is kind of touched on here in the Mail. But Celtic break Hearts. Is it just too easy a headline? Is that why they didn't?
I think even there was on Sky Sports, one of the former Hearts players was chatting on the panel, and he was saying there's going to be a serious amount of like Hearts puns, jokes coming in on this.
Well,
on the back of the last.
The cheapness, Fiona, unlike me, they've taken the high road.
I don't know if anyone uses it as a headline, but I saw it on social media yesterday. Martin Supreme. Which is a good headline. There you go.
There's lots more of that juice that we'll get into in just a little bit, but I want to switch codes to rugby. Ireland-Scotland, final round of the Women's Six Nations today at the Aviva. There'll be over 30,000 at it. 2:30, a middle game of the day, obviously in the final round of games. France-England close it out with the title showdown later on. So Fiona, here we are, morning of the game. Obviously, momentous occasion in a load of ways. First ever standalone game for the Irish women at the Aviva. The title, the record-breaking attendance is going to be there with that over 30,000. So obviously, as somebody who's represented Ireland at the highest level, and was part of the 23 that played there. It wasn't a standalone game, of course.
Yeah.
I know you've
Brian O'Driscoll's last game.
Yeah, so. It was overshadowed, yeah. Some would say, with that. But I know you've spoken to Owen in a bit more detail about that whole experience. But how big is this moment for Irish rugby?
Look, it's absolutely huge. I mean, I'm getting chills up me even thinking about the couple of thousand, I think, someone said that it was clocked the time we played something like 4,000 or 6,000 maybe, but I'm telling you, I was in the stadium, it wasn't. Okay. There was a few stragglers maybe counted as attending it. So to have that crowd there, I think the women's biggest sporting event was capacity was 31,500 around that for the soccer. So if they could even break that,
get close to that today, yeah.
They're looking at getting close to that, it would be huge for women's rugby. And I'm sure people have listened to me moan on enough over the years about the state of women's rugby, and I think in the last 2 years it's just been really nurtured, looked after, and this is the product of that. And that's why I almost get emotional thinking about the road, the journey we've been on, where the girls are at now. But it's a day for everyone. And to be fair to the RFU, they've tried to include ex-players and just all aspects of women's rugby. The under-18's done really well in their Six Nations competition. So they're going to get to walk the pitch at the Irish under-18's at halftime. Anyone that has been capped is getting your number. You know, none of us know, there was a lot of research done by Lynn Cantwell and people in the RFU over the last 6 months to find out the very first international up to date, and you'll hopefully get it. Now, I'm always saying it doesn't sound as good. You know, All Black number 7 sounds so good. It doesn't sound as good, Irish player number, but it's still...
Oh, listen, amazing. Yeah. Do you know what number you are yet?
No, so nobody has a clue. Okay. They've kept it under wraps, and we've been asking Lynn. I'd know Lynn, and not a chance. So that's going to be unveiled after the match, in a kind of in the president's suite in the Aviva. So it's just a magical day from anyone that started women's rugby to where the girls are at now and the journey they've been on. And it's the finish of the Six Nations as well. Unfortunately, they're not playing for a title, but if they can put in a performance today, I think you'll feel that is coming soon.
And then there's obviously the context of, obviously, you know, what had happened against Scotland last time out, last year, Scotland had a few injuries.
Yeah.
Like, there's a bit in the hurt locker, I suppose, from an Irish point of view as well, in that, like, you know, the France game and kind of what might have been. But so important that they deliver now.
Have to deliver. And look, there is a bit of pressure, you'll see it, but there's nobody going there other than to cheer and shout every single decision, breakdown, referee's call. So there's going to be so many people behind them, but there is a lot of talk after that World Cup and how they finished. So, you know, there's fight and talk there. We've seen it in definitely parts of games. I think they have a chance now to go out in front of this amazing crowd and really put on a show and have to deliver performance-wise. Scotland, on the other hand, you said, they're a thorn in Irish side over the years. I know I was up in Belfast a couple of years ago where Enya Breen kicked the winner in the last second. Ireland looked like they were breezing last year and Scotland came back, you know, so certainly they've beaten Ireland in the past as well, so they have that in their locker. But there's also, I think it's in a couple of the papers as well, Siobhan Cattigan, they're fighting for this trophy. That story to me is just unbelievable. I followed it, and if you're inside in that locker and you're Scottish, you are fighting for your life Anyone that's not hasn't a clue, basically there was a girl who was playing with Scotland a few years ago, and unfortunately she committed suicide and had a couple of concussions, and the family in particular really felt like Scottish Rugby didn't look after them. There was a mix up where maybe people were told not to attend the funeral or weren't given details of the funeral, and just the player welfare from a medical side, and also I think there was maybe a little bit of bullying they felt going on internally as well. So the Scottish, you know, didn't apologise at the time, because I don't know if there was lawsuits, but basically it seems to have been resolved, and thank God they've come out and apologised to the family, and said, like, we didn't treat you well enough. And on the back of, I suppose, chats and conversations with the family, this game is, they've created a title and a cup in Siobhan's name to play for. So if you, some of those girls would have played with Siobhan, you know, it's still fresh enough. So it is something that Scotland, yes, it's a huge day for Ireland, but I'd imagine it's a massive day for Scotland when you think about that as well.
David Walsh writes about it in the back pages of Sunday Times today. Forevermore, two teams will play for something greater than just victory or defeat. And he had spoken to Siobhan's dad 4 years ago, and he says about asking him about the effect of losing Siobhan and the impact of it. And, you know, he talks about, you're the dad, the head of the family, so whatever's wrong, you take it on and you fix it. And I didn't fix it. Like, I mean, there's just the legacy of people who die by suicide, obviously, is long and complicated. And David Walsh gets right into the teeth of it today in a piece that's very much worth digging out to have a read of that. One aspect of it Sinead Cassan takes on of the game today that I wasn't aware of until I read Sinead's piece, that the president, Catherine Connolly, had, I suppose I'll word it and say, she hadn't accepted an invitation from their IRFU to walk the red carpet in the same way, obviously, that she would have done for the men's game. That's a bit disappointing.
Yeah, because even though I remember we played up in Ashbourne and Michael D came out and they were trying to roll out something up in Ashbourne Rugby Club to get him out, but it was probably, and obviously since then we've had a few times with him, but it's something that always stands in your memory. The president of Ireland, it's a done thing at international level to just walk that carpet and be involved. So that is, I do think, slightly disappointing, because it's strange as well, because she's such an avid supporter of women's sport.
Yeah.
So yeah,
like, I don't know all the stuff, maybe there was a late note. I don't know, there's no explanation of why it didn't happen, but equally you would think you'd move mountains because of the optics of it. And
And as I said, it might be something small, but it actually is a huge part of players, what they see and how they approach games. Because if you look at it, you know, you're seeing it, we watch the men's game so much, you see it at that international level, and it's almost like you want to be able to replicate that and have the same big moments. So it is, I don't know, same Adrian, what went on in the background, but
I kind of feel like holding fire on the basis of maybe there's some sort of really, but it's very disappointing.
Or maybe just since the soccer skills, maybe she just into the soccer.
She wasn't there for the men's soccer game against Portugal in November either. Now Michael D, like you say, would turn out to anything, and be delighted to be there, and seemed to understand that his role in that was really important. But
I suspect it wasn't any kind of a deliberate snub, that there is a good reason why that she might have some prior engagement. But I don't know. Like, we've no clarity on that. I don't know. Like, one of the things that it struck me thinking about this game and the incredible amount of tickets have been closed is just the difference. Like, I started out in journalism in 1991, which is a long, long time ago. At that time, there was no prominent female Irish sports person, really, because Sonia O'Sullivan, her first Olympics was the following year. Like, she was still a student at Villanova. And that has been the biggest shift since I started. Like, it's been incredible. And it gets a lot of grief. And I know the reason for some of the criticism. But I do think Declan McBennett, the head of RT Sport, deserves credit, and Virgin Media Sport as well. Because now, and it's a horrible word to use, but watching women's teams now on TV is normalised. Mm. Like, there was a novelty factor at the start, and you had people just with stupid criticism because they weren't the same as men's team. Because why would they be? Like, they're different sport. Different. You don't watch the women's 100-metre final and expect them to run under 10 seconds. Like, it's different. But
And TG Cahir, we should
but put now, you, but now, like, people aren't watching out of sense of duty. Like, people are watching these games all the time. They're on regularly. Like, at the start, you know, RT might, or Virgin might have put on one or two games or whatever, but now they do it routinely, year after year, between women's football, women's soccer, rugby, Gaelic football and camogie. There's dozens of games on live TV now, which is a massive difference. And like, the context of that is, I remember I did this piece on 50 years of the Dublin football team and their relationship to the city. And I talked to a few of the first Dublin women's Gaelic football team about that. What was really interesting was, you know, asking about who were your heroes growing up and who did you look up to. It was all men.
Yeah.
There were no female role models, but now, because they're on TV, like the young, you know, the youngsters going to that game today, you know, if that was 20 years ago, they would have been, their heroes would have been Brian O'Driscoll, Shane Horgan, Paul O'Connell. Now they're Bevan Parsons and Erin King and Aoife Wafer. And that's a massive shift.
It's huge, absolutely.
And it's brilliant, yeah. And we know the characters and we know the dynamics of the teams and we follow and we grieve and we celebrate with them. In the same way that we've done with men's sports for eons, and it's that's brilliant. Come here, you've gone in depth talking about that Italy game with Owen before, so we won't do all that, but there was one story.
actually, we myself and Owen were chatting about it, but it just, I suppose, the story highlights how far the game has come and, you know, the high performance aspect, how it's kicked in. But I was thinking about it afterwards and I'd forgotten about this. We actually, and captains, when we went in for the captain's run, we saw the dressing rooms and we're in there and everything. But on the day, obviously, the Brian O'Driscoll's last game, they knew there was going to be people lagging around. It was going to be, so we were changing, and Italy were changing in Lansdowne, or the dressing rooms outside anyway, at the time.
Just across, so,
you just had to walk. Yeah. It was only a little walk, like, but so we were like, that isn't the issue, but it was so funny. We went out, we played, and at halftime we had to come back in and go into the dressing rooms. And it was a friend of mine that reminded me of this. And as we were going back in, we were all like, yes, hyped up, coming out, going through the changing rooms. We looked over at Italy and there was three Italians having a cigarette. And it was just like, oh yeah, halftime's over, put the cigarette out. And ran straight out into the Aviva, not a bother on him. Probably brilliant. Played the full 80 minutes as well. But it just shows you, imagine someone walking past now and you're in your jersey, your international jersey, having a cigarette on the sideline. But and that was 2014. But obviously, I'm not saying it, condoning it, but I just thought, wow, there's something special in Italy.
Brilliant tip of the cap to old school rugby, particularly. Right, well, that's it, and you're on duty for Virgin today, and then you'll be hightailing it over afterwards to get your cap.
We're all stuck in the studio, unfortunately. But yeah, we'll head over, as I said, for that function. But I'm so excited. I think I'm the only person who's ever played, or the three of us, that women's rugby, that won't be in the stadium today. It seems like it's just going to be hopping. Even lads from here, I met Cameron this morning, and he's on a day off from here, and he's going to the Aviva. Class. So it's just brilliant to see people even working in sport. Sometimes your day off, you don't want to be involved in that, but making a big effort to try and get the numbers out.
Yeah, it'd be great to see it surpass the soccer and just up the ante a little bit. And then
that's it, the old
pass
bit
it back again. Couple of other rugby bits we want to get to before we move on. One of them being Leinster demolishing the Ospreys at the Aviva yesterday. A bonus point was wrapped up and the game was over after the guts of 20 minutes. They were close to running in a point a minute, ended up 68-14 in the end. I was in Sligo over the weekend and somebody said to me about something, oh, geez, they'd edge you without salt. And it felt a little bit like that's exactly what was happening with Leinster and the Ospreys. So talk to us a bit about, I reading Rory O'Connor's piece this morning and he says that Bordeaux beat Perpignan in what he said was a dogfight. So you have two really different dynamics of domestic action heading into next weekend. Don't sit on the fence now, right? And tell me, we'll find out after the final whistle, which one is better prep?
I feel like where Leinster are at right now, they've had that dogfight, and it's normally the opposite way their season goes. They just cruise through the start of it and then the form kind of dips a little bit towards the end. I think they're on the opposite trajectory. So on the basis of what I saw in that match, like Joe McCarthy, I mean, come on. I think he's just, after coming into a serious bout of form, they look fresher it looks like, you know, by the end of the season, you're looking at the Leinster players, and yes, they have rotation early doors, but then you've got the internationals, the Six Nations, and on the back of the Lions tour as well, you just look at some people and they're absolutely drained. Ty Furlong was even flying around the place. There's huge competition there. I'm looking at it and I'm saying, who's going to miss out? Is Jimmy O'Brien going to miss out? Are they going to bring Frawley? Like, he's off to Connacht next season. I think that if they're going to have to do a 6-2 split with that big French pack. I mean, come on. I think Frawley has to be in. Yeah. I mean, you're looking at a 12, a 15, a 10, and you always have to carry a 9. So for me, it's him.
He's brilliant.
He's like, so good.
Every game that goes by now, I think Leinster fans are looking at it going, what's happening here?
And what's so exciting as well, like, is you're adding him to how good Connacht are at the minute. So you've got a Connacht team that are, I wouldn't want to be playing Connacht in the URC playoffs, and you're next year you're adding Frawley, you're adding a couple of guys to that. So it is actually exciting for Irish rugby, and this is what we want to see. But I feel like before a European game, the French are used to that dogfight, but I do believe being a little bit fresher, coming off the back of a big win, it's more about the body and I suppose the mind. So I do think Leinster going into it will feel, yes, we've got a big win here and I'm feeling good. So,
And Tommy O'Brien was taken out before the game, but Harry Byrne, Gibson Park both subbed at half-time. More for runners taken off as the game went
You felt like they were already looking at that. But certainly, like, you've got to feel, I feel for Sam Prendergast when I'm looking.
Probably
it is what it is.
Out, yeah.
But, like, going from being the number one in your country, and he probably mightn't even make the bench for this final. It's just the joys of rugby. But looking at that game yesterday, I just said, wow, like, a lot of people are talking about, you know, is their defence not working out for them, different areas. They just look like they're fresh and they're ready to go for me. Yeah.
Tapering at the right point of the season for Leinster would be a novel and, and good thing. Talk to us a bit about Munster, an 8-point win at home to the Lions, and they were behind at one point late enough in the game, but managed obviously to eke it out, secure the place in the playoffs. And in case you've missed it, Connacht have also snuck in there, but Ulster are the first team to miss out. 2 points behind Connacht as it happened, but on Munster. So Rory Keane picks it up here in the Mail on Sunday, particularly in relation to Clayton McMillan and obviously everything that's gone on and off the pitch for them. He says, Rory Keane says, it remains to be seen if some key figures are still in the building next season, namely Chief Executive Ian Flanagan. While Glenn McMillan still needs to source a new attack coach and forwards coach in the summer, he says the New Zealander has been an impressive figure throughout all this upheaval. Twice he fronted up to face the media this week. The former Chiefs boss has never avoided a tough question, and he certainly has put his best foot forward. Munster have a good coach there and they need to hold on to him. So I suppose the point being that there's going to be an awful lot of shake-up. It feels all the narrative, quietly in every other way, is that there's going to be shake-up at Munster, but in all of that, he needs to stay. What's your take on that?
I think it's going to be hard for him to stay. And when I'm watching him, and this is just my opinion, when I'm watching him, I don't know if I'm getting the vibes that he is staying. I don't know if they know what's happening in the background. Maybe he said, I need to bring in two guys completely myself, and it all could be connected around that. But look, maybe it's just his personality. There wasn't very much excitement after that win yesterday. I was watching them, and if I was coaching that team on the back of the previous performances, I would have been absolutely over the moon. They fronted up. They had three injuries before the game even kicked off, Jack Crowley being one, Evan O'Connell coming in. He was absolutely outstanding. A young player like that comes in and is saying, here, putting his hand up for a sooner start, you know. So I'm not too sure.
Hard for him to stay. Why?
I feel like if I say I'm bringing in this person and he's a friend of mine, which it would seem that, it's all passed, it's done, the job, like the contracts are signed, and then all this stuff starts coming out, and he obviously was like, we've got to stick with him, and they couldn't in the end. I just feel like, you know, as a coach, it's very hard to stay on with that when you're trying to bring in your own. You've worked with the coaching staff that's there. Obviously, at times it isn't working. You know, you're saying, okay, well, I want to bring this guy in from that I've worked with in the past. And then when that doesn't happen, I think sometimes when you're against an organisation, from what I hear, a lot of stuff went on in the background as well. You know, I just feel like you're going to go to the end of the season. Obviously, you can't leave mid-season, but it would be hard on the back of everything that's happened. You know, he suggested him. Like, he would have said, look, I
so
want...
what you're saying is that he would be one of the ones that might pay a price for that appointment?
No, I think it would be himself. Okay. I don't mean that. I mean, he would be like, I would imagine he's a mate. He's probably embarrassed. Like, if you do not and all this stuff, and he was like attacked by the media, rightly so, wrongly, I don't know. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying he has put his name in as he's the one that brought him over here. You'd be slightly kind of going, sorry about that. Obviously, they've had to, I presume, buy him out of his contract. So it's cost a lot of money. Yes, he's signed up to stay, but if he's bringing someone over, that means he's not too happy with everyone that's around him. He wants his own style of coaches beside him, and that didn't happen.
But would it not be a case of, like, listen, despite all the rancor that went on around it and all the conversation and the I was going to say the rights and wrongs, but the wrongs of the whole thing, right? So, but at some point, professional sports are pretty cutthroat.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can build a bridge past most things because that's kind of the name of the game. So from his point of view, is there not a, right, we tried that.
Okay.
It didn't work. Yes, there was a stink around it. Maybe others in the club are going to pay a price for that. But like, as far as I'm concerned, here's my new shortlist and on we go.
I don't feel like that, obviously. I don't, because if that was me and this is happening, you say, right, we're moving on, I'd be talking about, right, lads, look, like, we're still in this season, but we've got it. He's not even kind of focusing on next season or saying anything, look, when next year, or even discussing, maybe he can't, who possibilities of coming in or anything like that. He's just, obviously, you have to stay in the moment, and Munster have qualified now for Europe. They're playing... You know, they've got to go to South Africa, quarterfinal, semi-final.
Like, it could end up a very... Well, sorry, it's probably already quite a positive outcome from a rugby point
from
of view,
where
given where they were at.
Yes, huge, because there was a... Imagine the money involved with qualifying for Europe and not. So, I don't know. Like, I think he should stay. I think it's... You know, he was brought in. He's only had a year. He's after seeing players come in, go... Maybe he wants to sign a few players. Maybe he his ideas around that. We just haven't really heard much around anything on that outside other than this. So his interactions, I feel like maybe in the back of his head, he's just trying to get through the season. I hope I'm wrong.
You're reading from the outside in.
Feel like when I'm watching him in the chatting in those media pits, I could be very, very wrong. I do agree. I think he's a good coach. He's after spending a year with these guys. He can see who he wants to play, who he doesn't want to play. That was very unclear. There was a lot of chopping and changing all season long, which is fine for a coach in. They want to give guys a chance. So he will have a clearer picture. It would be terrible to bring someone absolutely new in again. Like,
you'd rather he stay on?
I'd rather he stay on and brought in a couple of fresh faces. Yeah. He'll have to bring in a fresh attack coach anyway, because that didn't work out.
A million, I think, is one of the pieces I read today. That would be the number they'd miss out on if that made Europe. Yeah. So obviously, given where they're at, that's a big one. You were taken by some of the anniversary pieces, a few of those Sunday Times and a few others.
I think this has been an issue with Munster a little bit in some years, in that they're too much of a hankering back to the glory days. But there are a couple of pieces going back to 2006 today. One piece in the Sunday Times going back to the semi-final with Leinster at the Aviva, with some of the players from both sides involved. That was the day when Munster won comfortably, and then a recall as well, a piece going back to the final, and Munster's win as well. Like, it does seem like 20 years ago, like, when it just, you forget, you know, that whole, you know, it was called an odyssey so many times and an obsession and going after. Like, I was at that game, and strangely enough, I was sitting beside Peter O'Toole.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because he was there as a promise to Richard Harris.
Right,
Richard Harris had died maybe two years or 3 years before that.
Right.
And he told Richard Harris that he'd be there when they won it. So he was there with him. Yeah, like, and I don't think he lived that much longer after Peter O'Doyle.
In the press area?
Yeah. I think the Daily Telegraph got him a pick. I think he, like, I got a few quotes of him, but I think they had I think they'd agreed to do a piece.
Was it like a few quotes as he was watching the match?
Basically, why are you here? Yeah. Like, what are you doing in the press? So he said, he told me that about the Richard Harris thing. But I think the Telegraph had... they got him a ticket and they'd agreed to a piece with him around it. So, it was remarkable. Like, you remember, like, it's referenced in the pieces here, the big screen in Limerick.
I was at the I didn't get to the match. Yeah, I was at the big screen. It was amazing.
Else. Like, the footage, that was...
that was so cool.
Things didn't go viral to the same degree 20 years ago, but that would have been a viral moment. Yeah. That reaction on the big screen was just amazing.
I'll tell you a quick story. Flannery's pub, it must have caught like fire or something. Jerry Flannery's, the one in and the ball and the side, we call it in Limerick. And I remember everyone was out lining the streets, but it's up to the side. And we went up, and next minute, the fire brigade had to go up and put it top. And about 10,000 people started singing "Fell Into Him," and the lads were just up going, "This is absolutely crazy!" Like,
surreal.
Everyone was just in having the time of their lives inside Limerick. What a day!
Heading into the press box that day, and you're like, "Oh, yeah, look forward to the game. Wonder, you know, who will I be beside?"
Lords of Arabia.
Wasn't on the bingo card.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I remember going to a game one day, and Brent Cobain, giant former Wales second row, I think he was, sat beside me. That's, you know, you've got Peter O'Toole.
I've got
having a cup of coffee spilled to me by Brent Cobain. And having to say to him, it's fine.
You're okay.
Don't worry about
I'm
it.
I'm not fighting you over
that. Go
to a Champions League final if you get a chance, because you go into the press room, you know, for beforehand, and it's just like...
Celeb Central.
Yeah. Everybody, like Louis Figo, Zidane, like everybody is there. And you go, wow.
It's all there.
Legends everywhere.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I've never heard that story before.
Yeah.
At what point did you feel, I'm going to have to... I can't let
very quickly.
Yeah.
No messing around. He was
dry at that point of his life, I think, was he?
I'm not sure.
I think there was a point. I watched some interviews and he's done.
He was very thin, he was very frail and very thin, yeah.
I've watched some of the down rabbit holes of his appearances on various American chat shows over the years. He's such a charismatic, proudly Irish institution.
Yeah.
Otherwise. One last round of the rugby that you wanted to mention, Fiona. It's Conor McKeown, hold the back page in the Sindo.
Oh, yeah.
Georgia doping bans come too late to repair the damage done. A story about Wayne Pivac, the former Wales coach.
Just looking at it from a coaching perspective, when you look at, you know, when he lost his job to Gatland in 2022, there was like basically there were one of the games was that Georgia game in Cardiff where they lost 13-12, and that would have been, I suppose, a tipping point. You know, if you're lucky, you'd expect Wales to win that game. And you know, you look back 4 or 5 years later, if you're a coach that was involved in that, and five of those starting players have been banned for doping for around that time, it's got to be frustrating. And especially with the, and we've chatted about it before, but just, you know, you'll always look at the athlete side of things, but sometimes you forget about the background people. When you read that article as well, he talks about, you know, how they were, one of the things was they were tipped off about them coming and just transferring the urine that came out. But someone like Pivac, if you're coaching that, and you read, you know, obviously it's one of, as a coach, that would probably be one of the worst games, you know, that you've coached, or that feeling coming off the pitch, having lost to Georgia. And when you look back at it then now and see that there was actually cheating going on, it's got to be very, very frustrating for him. It's too late, a lot of years later. But and I'm not saying that was what that game in particular was why, but it was, when you have a huge loss that you're expected to win, it certainly does add pressure in that area.
Yeah. Do keep the comments coming into us. We're midway through the Sunday Paper Review here on Off the Ball in the company of Fiona Hayes, that you've been hearing from there, and Kieran Cunningham as well. We're going to shift over to the soccer, and particularly the Celtic stuff. I was on the road for the first half of this game yesterday, and then couldn't wait to get back and stick it on, and like, just given what had happened just before half time, 1-1. So we'll give people a recap, and then we'll get into the teeth of what's in the papers today, because there is a lot of it. Hearts are going for the first title in 66 years. They're ahead for almost the entirety of the season, and they just needed a draw against Celtic, who were 1 point behind heading into the day. And there was all the even pre-drama of during the week where they got a late, and very controversial penalty in the previous game to even keep it alive going into the last day. So Hearts go 1-0 up on Celtic. It's just before half-time, and then Celtic get another perfectly legitimate penalty just before the break, 1-1. And it stays that way until about 3 minutes to go, and the title is going to Hearts, and the cameras are panning around the crowd, and the Celtic fans are biting their nails and they're panicked looking, and the Hearts fans are already starting to half mildly celebrate. And so 3 minutes to go in normal time, and Celtic score. Checked by VAR, the usual drama, and there's a player offside, but he's not the one who touches it the first time. So in the new world, all good, and Celtic go 2-1 up. Obviously, at which point, Hearts have to commit everybody forward, including the goalkeeper, for a corner. Celtic manage to get the ball. They run back up the pitch and lash it into the net for 3-1. There's still a minute to go of added time. Fans rush onto the pitch. The ref blows it up, or maybe he doesn't blow it up. Nobody quite knows if the full-time whistle is even gone. Even now, there's a lot of confusion. But eventually there is, at some point or another, a handshake. We believe we didn't get to see it, which was probably the most disappointing thing of the day between the two managers, Derek McInnes and Martin O'Neill. It happens in the tunnel afterwards, and Hearts are on the bus after 20 minutes at the end of the game back to Tynecastle, where their thousands are out to greet them home, where what they were hoping was a celebration, but obviously in the end ends up as a bit of a wake. And it's just about as dramatic as football can get. There's a brilliant graphic, like, you know, we often try to recommend a read for somebody if there's one piece you're going to go to today to get the cup of tea out. This one is nearly worth a look in itself. It's in the Sunday Times, and it's the graph of how the year has panned out and the various sort of dramatic pieces that happened along the way. But by and large, barring a slight dip for what looks to be maybe week three or four of the season, it's a purple line of Hearts all the way across until 2 minutes to go on the season. It's outrageous stuff.
Since 1st of October, I think Hearts were on top for 226 days. And Celtic were on top for one day, or a few hours of one day. But that was what mattered, incredible. Which is incredible. I watched it yesterday, and it's often the best drama is when two teams aren't of a really high standard. Yeah. And it's just far from a vintage Scottish season. Like, that's, you know, why Hearts, you know, have done so well. Partly the reason why Hearts have done so well. Like, Celtic, it's comfortably the poorest Celtic team O'Neill has ever won with. It's his fourth title, but the other teams were way ahead of this one. Hearts have done well, given, you know, the disparity in terms of the wage bill, the cost of the squad, etc. Yeah. They have the Brighton owner, and they're very sharp in terms of recruitment, and he has been very vocal about breaking the old firm duopoly.
Yeah,
but I don't think he thought it would happen this quick. Like, they did get breaks, Celtic without a doubt, but at the same time, if they'd persevered with O'Neill after he came in to replace Rodgers on a short basis, instead of bringing Nancy in, Celtic would probably have won the league with a bit of comfort.
Wouldn't have the gift here. Yeah.
No, we wouldn't have had to the extraordinary drama. And, you know, there's a couple of things on. Like, he's 74. I'm not sure how many older managers have won a league anywhere in professional soccer. He was effectively retired. He was doing a book tour there a while ago, like his latest book. He hadn't managed a club level since a disastrous 6 month spell with Nottingham Forest. Before that, his last year with Ireland was pretty dismal, you know, in terms of results, performances, his relationship with the media deteriorated badly, and he was largely being dismissed as a dinosaur, you know, who did a chip on both shoulders and who was yesterday's man. But, you know, he's won, and a lot of people were given credit to what he'd done in the past at club level to John Robertson, the late John Robertson, now as his coach. But he didn't have John Robertson this time. You know, he's Sean Maloney's coach. But what he always has had, and players will always tell you, is he's an incredible motivator. Mm. Like, it's often been said, they wouldn't see him training from Monday to Friday, but on match day he just gets alive, you know, comes alive. And that does matter. And I think particularly in a mad league like Scotland, it really matters, like motivation and not giving up, like the amount of goals they've got laid on. And, like, I know there's lots of people with the tinfoil hats on. I think that's down to referees all being in their pay. But no, a large part of it is just never giving up till the whistle goes. And like that was summed up yesterday. No, the scenes of the, you know, the, but I think that's part, there is a lawless edge to Scottish football and the, you know, the pitch invasion, things like that shouldn't happen. No. Very hard to stop a pitch invasion though when a lot of people are trying to get on, like no matter how many secure stewards you have. And if you looked at the, like it wasn't as bad as it could have been. Like a lot of it was young fellas just shouting abuse. Like there wasn't, I didn't see anybody punched or anything.
Well, I think we're still waiting for the full details of that because I think there might be stuff that, and like look at.
That we haven't seen, okay.
The crowd were booing them as well. Do you know what I mean? So the majority crowd didn't want that.
Can I ask you one thing about the, not to linger on it, right, because there are more important things to get into, and you touched on Martin O'Neill, and there's a great piece by Mark Palmer in the Sunday Times, and we'll get into that in a second, but just to linger for a moment on the mad penalty from the game during the week and the fallout of, you know, the Gary Linekers of this world saying he's never seen a more outrageous VAR decision. So I was watching that game and I saw some of the punditry as it happened, and they were very quickly on this thing of, this isn't a penalty, this is absolutely outrageous. And it seemed to set the tone for this commentary, which 95% of which was saying, this is a ball, this thing had set off that a ball couldn't go that fast if it hit your hand. And I don't know how many people repeated it. Like that, listen, Gary Lineker knows more about football than I could consider. But that's just clearly not true. And you know, also, sorry, the wildness of the player whose name escapes me, who had put himself in a position of basically trying to do a somersault in the penalty box.
I thought it was going to be
nobody's talking about.
The penalty could have been for the other way
and
as
I think
well.
Maybe,
like,
maybe somebody said to me yesterday that the VAR had started to look at the penalty incident because of the elbow. And then while that was going on, they went, oof, hang on a second here. There's something else, which might have been true. But any hypothesis about. It was if you step back from it, a fascinating watch in terms of
the transfer of it,
Of the narrative afterwards of, this is the most outrageous thing I've ever seen. It's evidently not the most outrageous decision. Even if it was proven that it wasn't a penalty, it's paper thin.
Yeah. But a part of it is the VAR hysteria at the moment, that people jump on everything now around VAR. And, you know, like the stats are out there that VAR gets the vast majority of decisions correct, and far more decisions are correct now than were correct before VAR. And the reason VAR was brought in was because of pundits and people like Gary Lineker laying into referees and linesmen when they got something wrong, when they didn't have the advantage of replays or whatever. Like, I do think I would put a 30-second limit on it.
Right.
You know, if you go back to the clear and obvious, if you can't, 30 seconds gives time for 3 or 4 replays. And if you can't tell after that, it's not clear and obvious. Like, move on.
Fair.
But when you get 5 or 6 minute delays, like.
Is the clear and obvious thing not a misnomer? Is the clear and obvious thing just there because, like, that one wasn't either clear or obvious, but that didn't seem to be.
Well, it seems to be discarded. Like, that was what was mentioned at the start, that was clear and obvious, but that seems to be discarded long ago. But I did find it funny because I ended up watching, but I watched a lot of the FA Cup final on TNT. And Ali McCoist was on co-commentary, and he was really hoarse. And I was thinking, he wasn't cheering on Celtic earlier. I think he was hoarse.
But even with that, I think, do you feel as well, Kieran, that they, when the referees call to the screen, it's they're going to say,
99 times out of 100. Like fans start celebrating when they see that happening.
I don't know why they go through that, because that's a pantomime to me. I think the VAR had made the decision. They should just say, you know, like in rugby, you know, that. Often the VAR makes the call.
You look at the ref then as well, and isn't there like wasn't there a police guard on him and his family? He's addressed his online.
That's part of the madness. Yeah. That's happened so often. You know that refs have been threatened and. There is a toxicity to Scottish football. Like Neil Lennon had, you know, his home attacked and all sorts of stuff when he was Celtic manager, but.
Double Top Donald says, I wonder if that French lad who managed Celtic for a few games this season, he's referring to Wilfred Nancy, will get a winner's medal. How many times has a club sacked their manager and then gone on to win the title in the same season? Two managers, it turns out.
Yeah. I presume it's never happened. Well, two managers definitely. But
he also touches on something else. I had to laugh at the Celtic fans at the stands biting their fingernails after winning 13 of the last 14. I think it might actually be 14 of the last 15.
Aston Villa won the European Cup in a season where they got rid of their manager.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. But the 14 out of the 15 thing, that wasn't the point. The graph in the Sunday Times was the point. They were really
down and out. Yeah,
not never, but almost never ahead until the last 2 minutes of the season. It's outrageous. Yeah. Like, it's documentary stuff.
Yeah,
definitely Netflix.
And like the other night, said Hearts had it won. Like, Hearts players were on the pitch. Yeah. Waiting to get the word so they could start
the
celebrating.
Out,
their game had finished and they were waiting to be told we could start celebrating. We won it. And then
they had pictures of the trophy stand coming out and then all the lines going back in again.
I mentioned Mark Palmer's piece. I think it's the best of them when it comes to Martin O'Neill across the papers today. It's in the Sunday Times. Written off as a dinosaur, this title belongs to O'Neill. This isn't a puff piece in any way, shape or form. He says in O'Neill, Celtic possessed something of a cheat code, a man whose knowledge, skill set and ability to communicate were tailor-made for these specific circumstances, where so many in the Celtic hierarchy this year have seemed intent on stumbling up blind alleyways. O'Neill has held his line beautifully. He says the football has often been a stodgy, starchy, scrappy struggle, but the character and resilience that are the hallmarks of the 74-year-old Olds teams were there in abundance.
Yeah, and off the field, like, it's been a really fractious season. Like, if you remember the AGM and Dermot Desmond's son, I can't think of his first name, but he read a long statement. What he laid into, in very strong language, substantial sections of the board. You had the Green Brigade, who would be a prominent group, who were banned. They would be campaigning for Palestine and various causes, and they'd be quite vocal and on different issues. And they were banned from Parkhead for several months of the season. So there's always been sorts of things going on. There's been lots of calls for Dermot Desmond to be removed. So all that background noise was going on.
The Brendan Rodgers stuff, do you remember all that? And the Ross Desmond is the son, and the statement that was released afterwards.
Yeah, Rodgers, in his interviews before he was out, like, made it very clear he thought he hadn't been backed in the summer, and he wasn't given the list of targets he had. The Celtic didn't get any of them for him.
But it was the flamethrower, one of them describes the statement that came out afterwards about how it absolutely set light to Brendan Rodgers about toxicity and all sorts of stuff. Rory Smith is another piece in the Sunday Independent. Yeah. O'Neill has done more in the two spells than guide the club to the title for the fourth time in his career. Celtic's fifth in a row and their 56th in their glittering history. He has healed, at least temporarily, the thing that you're talking about, Kieran, a rift between sections of the fan base and Celtic's hierarchy. In return, as he said in the pitch before the trophy was presented, these players and the coaches have given me a reason to live. The story of Martin O'Neill around all this, like, you know, you touched on it earlier in terms of his relationship with Ireland and the Irish fans towards the end of days of his time there, but, like, you want to be cold of heart to not take delight in what he's done.
No, I think it's a great story, and, you know, it puts him, you know, when RTÉ Sport, because he was on the Old Phillips Manager of the Year Awards. I think O'Neill might have won it one of the years. So, you know, he should be in the running for the RTÉ Sport. Now he's the only one now, but he should be up there as one of the contenders for Manager of the Year, Irish Manager of the Year.
Yeah, and I think as well on that, you know, there's so much like stats and all this kind of stuff out there. It actually hits home how important the power of emotion is, the power of man management, how he's able to come in and it is a basic squad that he had, and he came in and completely, yes, there was results elsewhere that helped in his favour, but he completely changed how they were playing. Even, you know, even with people were shocked with Osmond coming on
Callum
the bench,
Osmond,
you know what I mean, and then he came on. I know there was no goalkeeper when he scored, but still it just seems like the decisions he made, and it's always a big thing for me when teams win, when you see him going straight over to the manager. There's something special there.
He was a classic case of one who had been out of the squad under the various other managers, and Neela brought him
and
in.
And he brought him in.
But that bit of, like, management is such a curious thing, isn't it? Like,
it is, because they tell you it's kind of dead and gone, and, you know, everything is based on you know, style of play, everything like that. Yes, there's a little bit of that that is important, but I think that just showed me how very, very important. And even his interviews afterwards, he's such a gent, you know, you can see he's, everyone absorbs when he's speaking, you want to listen to him. So yeah. it's a big part, and we forget about that sometimes, especially when we're looking at the Premiership as well, and you're looking at different managers gone. He had the ability to get the best out of those players.
Liam Scales as well getting the medals, a nice story.
Brilliant game yesterday.
Yeah, he was.
And a player who would have been under a lot of fire, not recently, but previously from Celtic fans themselves.
Yeah.
Really good.
And also, Celtic in the Scottish Cup final, and it's O'Neill against Neil Lennon in that final. So that's a nice little story as well. So the Scottish madness won't end for another while. Yeah.
I'm going to say something now, and I'm going to urge YouTube listeners to listen to what I'm saying. Celtic against Hearts is going to be the footballing rivalry of next season. Footballing rivalry.
Yeah.
Not talking about the other stuff.
Yeah.
But just given the nature of the season, how it panned out, given what happened at the end of the game, given what happened on the pitch, given that they got in the bus, I think that, like, imagine next season, spool forward to the first game.
And it's mentioned Rory Smith's article, Tony Bloom, the Brighton owner, and their, the Jamestown Analytics, which they use to find players, and that they're the only Scottish club with access to that data.
They choose one club per league to sell their data.
Bloom has been very clear on it. And, you know, Martin O'Neill in his quotes afterwards is, this is a wake-up call for Celtic and Rangers. You know, Hearts aren't going away. Mm. You know, which is interesting. Like, this can be a starting point for Hearts. Like, people are assuming this is a blip and, you know, it'll go back to another 10 in a row for Celtic, and maybe Rangers might win the odd, wouldn't they?
It doesn't feel that way.
It doesn't. No, McGuinness has... They just fought for... Yes, obviously things went wrong, but even the game at home, they were unbelievable. I mean, the midfield in particular, I wouldn't say cost, like in today's modern game, cost a lot of money. And even in that first half against Celtic, they absolutely controlled everything. They'll probably look back with regret in how they set
back. It's cruel, isn't it? When you look at it from that side.
You should just stick with your philosophy and do it for the whole 80 minutes. There obviously is, you're looking at, I know you have to say, all we need is a draw here. It kind of came into play near the end.
Yeah.
But certainly, I think there's something brewing in Hearts, and the way it ended, you're right, there's going to be a lot on next season, but they have the talent to do it.
You made a Freudian slip there and said do it for the whole 80 minutes, and that's unfortunately
unfortunately what happened. Yes, you're right.
Come here, there was one last bit on the Martin O'Neill stuff that I just want to mention at the end of the Mark Palmer piece, and it sort of, I think it came up in commentary a little bit yesterday. One man deserves all the praise, and regardless of any statue, a billing only second to Steen in the pantheon of Parkhead managers, many would argue such a spot was already his long ago. But what a way to seal the deal. So a statue for Martin O'Neill at Parkhead, it feels, is an inevitability almost.
Yeah, it has to be. I mean, that is just, even you spoke about age, like coming back in, you know, you think you'd be enjoying your retirement.
What happens to him now then? Does he, there's some chat, maybe he goes upstairs?
There's been talk of Robbie Keane and with Martin O'Neill overseeing it, but it remains to be seen, you know. Robbie's still under contract, I think, for another year. And
he lost the league, didn't he?
He lost the league, yeah. First manager in 8 years not to win the league with him. He did win the cup, and he does seem to be, they seem quite happy with him in Hungary. But I think if Celtic came knocking, he wouldn't turn it down. He did play there on loan before. Mm-hmm. And it does seem, you know, people do see it as a stepping stone to the Premier League.
Yeah.
Elsewhere on managers, Tommy Conlon, Mourinho needs the devil inside. Real Madrid gig is likely to bring out the badness in Jose once again. he says here that a decade going around in ever decreasing circles, he's back in the mega big time. It's a sort of gig that's bound to get his juices flowing again if the tap hasn't permanently dwindled to a trickle. That's the funny question about Mourinho that nobody can quite figure out, that he's sort of gone off on a bit of a journeyman tour of clubs, and he's not really been Jose Mourinho. He's been what do the kids say now? A Timu.
Yeah, because we're talking about, you know, yesterday's man and dinosaur, and a lot of people have been putting Mourinho into that category and figuring his best days are gone. But if he went into, you know, you do look at Arsenal and the way Arsenal play, and it's not un-Mourinho like. Mm. You know, he might well be, or Real might even be looking at that and think, you know, Arsenal may well win the Champions League and the Premier League, and they play in a way that Mourinho plays. But, you know, from all we've heard about in recent weeks, the rows with Mapapi and Tchouameni and, you know, the Arbeloa and the fights on the training ground, etc., it would be a very fractious dressing room, and there's nobody better to...
make it more fractious.
Yes. So
well,
I don't
Vinnie
know.
Junior stuff.
I don't know if that's what they want.
But that happened, I just thought, because it had been rumoured before that, and I just thought, well, that's obviously the end of that now.
And yeah, and like, what would he do with Trent Alexander-Arnold, who doesn't really want to defend?
Yeah.
I don't know.
We should be about to find out. There's lots of stuff about managers today. We mentioned Xabi Alonso at the very top of the piece and how he's been confirmed back at Chelsea for 4 years. Paul Rowan has a couple of pieces in the Sunday Times. One, a reflection on the Ireland beating of Granada in Murcia yesterday, 5-0, the result there. He has some stuff about Seamus Coleman and Katie McCabe, obviously bringing down, well, he says bringing down the curtain on their club careers. I don't know if that's quite the case, obviously, with McCabe, but the piece that I've honed in on here is Duff and Keane looking ever likely to follow in the footsteps of Andrews. So, obviously, Keith Andrews has been nominated for the Premier League Manager of the Year award. I mean, it feels like he might be an outsider for that, but... he gets into talking about Damien Duff, and like, he was on Virgin, remember, was it last week or the week before? Yeah. He was talking about that he'd been over at Brentford, and Tommy was probing him about what that was all about and who he ran into and all that. It was very interesting, 5 or 6 minute watch. But Paul Rowan writes, Duff might rock the boat at Brentford given his high profile, and the notion of that was put to Keith Andrews, possibly by Paul Rowan, I think, in the media duties this week. Keith Andrews says, I don't think that's fair on Damien, so I won't have that said about him because he's a really good friend. When I looked at coaching options going back to last season when I was appointed, I met some high profile people who might fit the category you're alluding to, a big name, big character or a big CV. Wouldn't have deterred me then, and that was before I was, I suppose, unproven, if people want to say it that way, and it certainly wouldn't be now. God, this would be like...
That's before I was unproven.
As in, I think what he's wanting to say is, I have some credit in the bank.
Yeah, I've done a bit now.
But in typical Keith Andrews way, he doesn't want to, obviously, or none, nor would any of them want to big themselves up too much.
Yeah,
reading between the lines, I have a feeling he might be going to Brentford.
Yeah.
Is there an aspect of it? So that bit where the premise here is that the profile of him might rock the boat at Brentford. I think if you were to go down that path, I wouldn't talk so much about the profile, but the nature of his previous job and how like emotionally invested.
Yeah, but there's I think it's Rowan's piece mentions there, you know, when he was at Celtic, he was very, you know, low-key Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, when he was in with, you know, it was only a brief spell, but he's well able to stay in the shadows too, Duff. You know, so it depends what he wants. When you have a taste of being the manager, do you want to go back to being a coach? You know, it depends what
that's
he
the
really
thing,
wants.
Isn't it? Yeah.
He strikes me as the sort of fella that, I don't know, he probably would be happy enough to do something like that. And
I'm surprised because he had been so emphatic that, you know, his future was in the League of Ireland, and I thought a large part of that was family reasons because. Football management, if you go into it in England or wherever, you know, it's such a disruptive life. Mm. Like, as far as I know, Arnie Slot's family still live in the Netherlands. And that's the case with a lot of them. They're living... Remember Mourinho, when he was at United, famously lived in the Lowry Hotel. His family, I think, lived in London at the time. But, some people don't want that life, you know. And I thought, I got the impression that was the reason Duff was constantly on the League of Ireland, that he was happy in Dublin with his family. Is he in Dublin or Wicklow? I can't remember where he lives now. But happy in Ireland with his family. But maybe he's just got the
leafy suburbs of Twickenham and Richmond, Kieran, come calling.
Also he was very emphatic that he didn't want to manage against Shelburne. So
he did say that.
So what do you do then if you want to go back into coaching?
Well, I think that might be, I think, because he's got a relationship with Shamrock Rovers as well.
That could be just now as well, do you know, in the aftermath
of
everything.
Of course.
Fiona, the piece here, Shane McGrath, the Mail on Sunday, Andrews shines in League of Outlandish Ambitions. I've mentioned the nominee for the Manager of the Year, and he's in pretty, pretty illustrious company, in fairness there. But yeah, there's a piece like it's kind of summed up here in the final paragraph of the entire piece. He says, from managing... to excel even in one season in such a maelstrom, Andrews has become a man apart. And the context to Keith Andrews is generally this bit of, we mentioned Tony Bloom earlier, and the owner of Brentford is basically gave birth
in the non-literal sense, to the owner of Brentford, and it's very much the same model of this data and analytics. And quietly, there's kind of a like, sure, anybody could go in and do that. But no. I think Shane McGrath's piece is saying, well, that's not necessarily true. And Keith Andrews has done a fine, fine job, to say the least. They're still pushing for Europe with a couple of games to go.
Yeah, he's been unbelievable. And for someone, I suppose, some people might have said, who at the start of the season, even in managerial like company, for him to come in and do that? And I know I spoke about it earlier, but you can see the players, they enjoy him. So there's something, there's all that analytic stuff and they've gotten the best. And I think even, you know, the likes of Kelleher, there's a couple of guys there that are playing out of their skin, but he is behind that. You know what I mean? He's how he structures the team, how he goes about playing football is just a joy to watch. And yes, it's simple for people to say you have something written down that's there for you, so it should be easy to transfer that onto human beings and help them do it. But I'm coaching, that is not the reality of it. And in today's, there's always characters in the dressing room, but in today's day and age, there's absolutely numerous different types of characters in dressing rooms. So I think he's gone over and just been unbelievable. And he's a very calming influence as well. So I would imagine when things are going wrong, that when you get in at half time, he's able to come up with the right stuff to say to get his team out playing. And it's just one of the stories of this season from an Irish point of view in particular.
Well, having Duff there would be like, we think we're all watching out for Brentford now.
Yes, I'm going behind the jersey. Yeah. But yeah, no, there and a couple of Irish guys in this squad as well. I mean, like it's good. I remember supporting Liverpool or people supporting when I was much younger, Aston Villa, because there was Steve Saunt to Paul McGrath. You know, I would have looked at even when McAteer was there with Liverpool and I wanted to go over with my dad when I was younger. So it does have a huge influence. And, you know, you get someone else over there, we'll start seeing a lot of Brentford jerseys around the place.
My 4-year-old's going around in a Brentford jersey, albeit he swapped it out today for a West Mead jersey.
Right, He was forced to do that, was he?
Do you know what? I won't lie, Fiona, it was one of my proudest parenting moments last week when I got a shout from the top of the stairs saying, about 9:30 at night, mind you, Dad, can I get my Westmead jersey tomorrow?
Yes.
And I was like, this is... Stop the clock.
This is what I've been waiting for.
I'm using that as a segue onto our next piece, because I know both of you are desperate to talk about events at Croke Park today, so we'll give you your dues here. Sunday Independent is where we go, and there's loads of lovely pieces today, it must be said, in and around the Leinster final and the Ulster football final as well. But this one, we're going to kick off Dermot Crowe emerging out of the shadows. Westmeath are on the rise and feel buoyant ahead of Leinster decider. And there's loads of lovely little aspects of this around harking back, obviously, to the golden age, I suppose we want to call it that, from the mid 2000s, and bringing that forward. And just there's some quotes here. Pat Doherty, been one of them, who is a working for Westmeath GAA, and he says it's not an All-Ireland final, but it's the next best thing for a county like Westmeath, and dare I say it, we're in with a real chance. That's not to say we're going to win it, but we're going with real hope. The numbers travelling in maroon and white are 20,000 strong, and this seems to be a big aspect of it as well, that, do you know, the Owl was at the Marty line, last person out, turn out the lights. There seems like an element of that, and that there's a potential even that the maroon jerseys might outnumber the blue ones.
Yeah, you know, I saw talk about that during the week, right, that I think at that stage we're looking at 35,000 crowd and 20,000 tickets have been sold in Westmeath, so it would be remarkable if that turns out to be the case. Like, Westmeath have already won 3 Leinster Championship games, and it was Dermot Crosby's mentions, and the 8 Leinster Championship campaigns between 2017 up to last year, they were beaten the first day out, 6 of those. Mm. So to win 3 games already is incredible, especially when you lose Luke Loughlin, who would make any team in the country, including, you know, Kerry, Donegal, Armagh. I think he's top class. You know, they've had other injuries as well, and that's probably why John Heslin has been taking out of retirement. And what they do with him today would be really interesting, because I presume he's not being brought back just to sit there on the bench. Like, I presume he will be used, because it's a great opportunity. Like, Dublin weren't bad at all against Louth. Cormac Costello took on the mantle up front, with Conor Callan not being there. But they're definitely not anything like the Dublin team that hammered Westmeath regularly in the last decade. Mm. So Westmeath have a chance, but they're very much outsiders, but they have a chance.
7-1 on Dublin are to win the thing. 4-29 to 10 points was one of the games that you're alluding to from mm. 2017. But
yeah, I think he says 10 years ago we were going to Croke Park and slaughtered by Dublin. He said it's different this time, so there is a sense of belief. He doesn't say we're going to win, but he says we're not going to get slaughtered this time.
Westmeath, as you know, I've got a lot of things right. Westmeath School won the Hogan Cup, which is the main colleges competition this year at minor and under 20 football. They've beaten Dublin this year. Darren McGee is in there as head of games, a former Dublin midfielder. He's done a lot of good work. Jack Cooney, whose son is playing, has done a lot of good work coaching there. And I suspect Jack is one of the reasons Mark McHugh is manager, because he's married to a woman from Kilcar, where Mark McHugh is from, in Donegal. And I would say that's the connection. Like, Mark was in there as a coach
under Dermot McCabe.
Yeah. But like, he's only 35. Like, if he wins a provincial title at 35, it's incredible.
Bolster a CV for Donegal, Kieran. Is that why we're looking at it?
Yeah, and he would have been seen as a very unlikely manager on that 2012 team. He's seen as a very intelligent footballer and knows a lot about the game, but people didn't really see him as a manager in waiting. But he's cut his teeth. Like, he was in club level in Galway, coached with Roscommon, coached with Westmeath under Dermot McCabe, and he coached with a Donegal women's team. So already at only 35, he's a fair bit of coaching experience under his belt. And it would be remarkable if they won it, because, his father, Martin, would have taken Cavan to a very unlikely Ulster title. So father and son to win and manage them to would be two provincial titles would be something else.
It's Jack Cooney went to Donegal with a view, it comes up in one of the pieces, with coaching Donegal with a view to becoming the Westmeath manager.
Yeah, yeah.
And they talk about, some of the Westmeath players at that time talk about the belief that gave them, that like, here was a fella, local fella, who was willing to go and put the miles in, but like, he wasn't getting involved with the county that profile at Donegal for the sake of that. He was doing it for the sake of bringing it back to Westmeath. So there is that. Conversely, that McHugh here is putting himself, if you look at it from a Donegal point of view, like, very much, and I don't know that Jim McGuinness is going anywhere anytime soon, but like, he is very much putting himself in the shop window to be the next man in.
Well, one thing that Jim McGuinness' future struck me yesterday, that Donegal were being hammered by Monaghan and the minors, and they came back from 10 or 11 points down to win, but that was due to 2-4 from Mark Anthony McGuinness, Jim's son. So I was thinking, maybe he'll be one to wait till the sun comes through. He'll hang on till the sun comes through.
Minor,
he'd be 17. So he'll give another year or two. But I thought, because it's interesting, because you had this trend that inter-county managers were always 3 or 4 years, and people, it's too much to give up.
Yeah.
But now you're seeing, like, Kieran McGeaney's been there a long time. Yeah. Jack O'Connor sticking around again in his third, and like, Jack O'Connor's retired as a teacher now. Porrick Joyce is in his seventh or eighth year. And I've been feeling Jim McGuinness might go in for the long haul too now. I don't know the reasons for that. Some of the reasons you can only speculate on, but I do think people see it more now as something you can do for medium to long term rather than just short term.
Well, he'd be desperate to put right the wrongs of the end of last year.
Yeah.
They're just in Westmeath. There's some good stuff going back to their only Leinster championship success in 2004 under Paddy O'Shea, and I particularly like the piece in the Mail by Shane McGrath with Pat Collins. And Pat Collins is a director, like, some people might have seen the film That They May Face the Rising Sun on the John McGarren novel, which is a lovely film, but he also made Marooned, a documentary behind this, a fly in the wall documentary about that seasons, which there would be a few viral moments on it, like Paddy's speech about a grain of rice will make the difference. But I think more famously, the one that still comes up on TikTok, and I'll leave out the swearing, but you give an out to a player in a huddle about you were thrown out over the on the sideline like a loaf of bread. That's I don't know who throws a loaf of bread over a sideline.
Let no Westmeath man, Alan, be thrown over the line like a loaf of bread. Alan Mangan, he was on with us during the week. And he was talking about that moment, and he said that he was getting the bollocking and in the middle of the huddle. The main thing he was thinking was, well, at least he was giving me this bollocking. I haven't played well the last time, but I have to start now. We can't do that and then not start me. There's so many lines out of that thing that, you know,
has carried on.
You were like talking about the goosebumps earlier, Fiona. I need to get on the road soon. Come here. There's a few other pieces like that we'll mention. And Joe Brawley takes on the thorny issue of Fitzy for Love Island of the Sunday Independent. I thought it was very much playing the man and not the ball, I have to be honest. But anyway, look, if that's your thing, go for that. I know you liked, Kieran, and put people in the direction of the Michael Foley piece around Gabriel Bannigan, obviously, and head of the Ulster final today as well. That's in the Sunday Times. But we probably have time for one more piece, so we'll go to Paul Kimmage in the Sunday Independent. Yeah. McCarthy's comments raise more questions, is the headline here. So, further reporting on the story that Paul Kimmage himself had led, obviously, around the Irish rowing team and the culture around the high-performance team, and specifically the former high-performance director, Antonio Margiovanni. So this piece is about the two-time Olympic champion, Fintan McCarthy, obviously. Some pieces that he did last week around a promotional event, and he spoke about the aftermath of the reporting and the stories. It's very difficult to leave anything out of the quotes, but I'll do my best to sum the piece up here as best I can without reading you the full thing. So Fintan McCarthy says, from my side, this is in recent days, from my side, it was a really, really hard time, probably the hardest few months of my career so far. There have been so many changes in my eyes made in order to improve the welfare and make us a bit more central in the decision-making process. For all that to come out after a year where we had so much growth and success was tricky to navigate, to be honest. He says, I was surprised by some of it. I obviously had my own perspective and some of what was included in those articles. But at the end of the day, everyone has their own version of reality, I guess, and you're never going to get everyone totally on the same page. Finally, on this aspect of it, he says, it's fair enough for everyone to have their voice and their perspective. I just think maybe it was very heavy on certain perspectives, but I guess that's what sells papers. So that was his bit from last week, obviously in reflection on events of the previous few months. Second aspect to it is a very long email from Fintan McCarthy to a non-exec director at Rowing Ireland and the aftermath of the Olympics. And again, I can't read all of this, but we'll give you a couple of excerpts that I think will get to the core of it. He says in this email that's printed here in full, I feel the need to email you, he says to this non-exec director, to be explicit about my experience and observations of the current programme in the hope that the board is completely informed on making important decisions. He goes on to say the board are not fully aware of the severity of the situation or may even believe that what's happening is necessary in order to produce results. I say this as some athletes too have been led to believe that endorsing these issues is what high performance requires. However, upon reflection and discussion, I've come to the conclusion that many of us have been manipulated into disregarding our own welfare. And on it goes. They are two very different stories.
Two different perspectives
from the same person.
Yeah, and both coming from Fintan McCarthy. I think from that email that Paul Kimmage has revealed, that was sent a month after the Paris Olympics, you know, when he's become Olympic champion again, like along with only Paul O'Donovan has cut more clout in Irish rowing because of their track record than Fintan McCarthy. So what he says really matters. So in effect, if you go through the full text of that email, it backs up a lot of the things that were come out in the Sunday Independent investigation. And, you know, the fact that so many of the rowers ended up having to get psychological help. And I don't think that's something you can downplay.
No.
And I was a bit surprised then. Like, he's obviously given, I would suspect he's given private support to a lot of those rowers.
Yeah.
And he made a stand by contacting Rowing Ireland on it. But I do find it a bit disappointing that he didn't back that up when he was asked about by Cathal Dennehy, and you know, throwing in that line about what sells papers. He knows from that email, he knows there's more to it than that, than just selling papers. That there were definite issues going on,
yeah.
And I think when you have that kind of clout and that kind of stature, you know, you can speak out and that helps in making sure something like this never happens again. Because, you know, Rowan Ireland and Sport Ireland were put up before the Rochtas committee over this and they performed very badly. And it showed there was a lot of problems with the way the high performance system was being operated. And, you know, we still haven't got answers from key people within Rowing Ireland over the whole affair. So I would have suspected Finn McCarthy knew he would be asked about it. So I thought he would have a better response ready.
Yeah. You know? Well, there's a bit of flux at the top of Rowing Ireland as well, obviously, yeah. with various roles. And then there's a new high performance director, and then it's difficult for him to have
but
to
there are people, there are key
beforehand.
People who were there at the time still there. Yeah.
But yeah, it feels as if he's done the important work by sending a really clear email.
Yeah.
And like, so maybe his instinct is, well, I don't really want to relitigate all of this, and, you know, where I'm at in my preparation or whatever else doesn't serve me best, and I feel as if
He is making a transition into heavyweight. You know, he's got a big championship coming, like he's under a bit of pressure.
Maybe as they say, with mature recollection or reflection, he'll at some point.
Yeah,
say,
but
well,
I do think some of the other rowers would have read that. You know, who went through the mail over this, and they would have been disappointed.
They probably would have known about the email as well, and like it's certainly a juxtaposition of views. Greg says that I would love Westmead to do it, but can't see it. Croker is 80,000, only 20,000, says Greg, who's raining on my parade already before it begins. Poor show, this is your biggest day out. Somebody else points out that they think, and I'm not sure exactly what the number is, but that the population of the county is 100,000, so I suppose it's not that bad. Anyway,
22nd highest population, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's in one of the pieces.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know that offhand. I don't do them all. I don't do them all.
I don't know that.
Very impressive. Who's at 21 is what the listeners demand to know. That was brilliant. Really enjoyed that. Thanks a million.
Cheers.
What's the margin going to be at the Aviva today?
Yeah.
Is that there's no point in asking who's going to win it?
No, I think they'll win by a couple of tries. I think the second half, Scotland have a few injuries as well. Ireland are pretty strong across the board.
Congratulations and good luck today yourself, because it's a momentous day that they don't come around very often, and it's due recognition for a brilliant career for yourself and the rest of your teammates.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'll go to the Aviva after work, and so it's just everyone's going to be able to relax then and just get to see how many wrinkles we're all after getting over the years.
Brilliant.
Well, enjoy it.
Good luck with it, and thanks a million for making time for
no
us.
No problem, Les.
As well, Kieran. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
That's it for the pay-per-view for today.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.